Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. Officially, the 43rd hottest podcast in the world, according to Podcast Magazine's Hot 50 Countdown. Thank you so much to everyone who voted for the show. If you've got a spare 30 seconds and you'd like to vote for us again for this month, whichever month it is you're currently listening in, please give in to that urge and go to podcastmagazine.com/hot50. That's H-O-T-5-0. And type our name into the ballot box. Thank you in advance. Or in response. Like I say, it really depends on when you're currently listening to this. But now onto the reason you're playing this episode. My first guest of Season 3. My guest today is an executive director at the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, where he leads the Technology and Public Policy Programme. He's also a member of the advisory board at Digital Leaders, curator of the AI website Deep Index, and a trustee of Enable Scotland. He was previously a general manager at Uber and has held senior roles at institutions such as Policy Exchange, McKinsey & Co., HM Treasury, and the Cabinet Office. So it's fair to say he knows about policy, which is fortunate, as I was keen to find out exactly how effective policy comes to be written and put into practice. Over this episode, you'll learn just that, along with why a 1999 episode of The West Wing was particularly prescient, the benefits of policy over politics, and why he's so optimistic about the decades ahead. In short, we had a great conversation, and it was one which I was so excited to begin, I only had a backup recorder going when we first started, hence the improvement in audio quality upon the second question. So let's get straight to it. Please welcome my guest for this week, Chris Yu. Chris, thanks so much for coming on Spieling the Beans.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, we'll start with a presumably quite a straightforward question. How would you define and describe policy?
That is such a good question, and one that I think, you know, I and a lot of people wrestle with a lot of the time. The way that I think about it is in a few components. So I think about defining a problem and structuring the analysis to understand it. I think about forming hypotheses about the best ways to respond to the challenge or to secure the opportunity that you're trying to achieve. And then I think about the narrative that you build around your conclusions and how you explain that to other people. And I think if you do all those three things well and you ally them to a particular, you know, perspective or point of view on the world, then you get to hopefully a good policy outcome.
Fantastic. How would you define great policy? And what is it about it that makes it particularly stand out?
I mean, the ultimate test of great policy is that it gets implemented.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So like a lot of policy work, I think, you know, can be very intellectually coherent, but it can fail that final hurdle. But, you know, assuming you clear that, then I think the best policy is a policy that is clear, that is... you know, very cognizant of the trade-offs that you're making when you put it together, because the world is complicated, right? And a lot of the decisions that policymakers wrestle with do not have straightforward answers. Mm-hmm. And I think more so now, perhaps, than in the past, you know, policy needs to be, if not future-proof, at least have the flexibility to cope with a world that's changing very, very quickly, right? And lots of the things that, you know, lots of the policy challenges that we see around us today, often you trace back to quite a big dissonance between the way the world was when they were first crafted and the laws went on the statute book, and the way the modern world now is and the pressures that it puts on different people and different institutions. So like I say, you can't fully design for that, but you can certainly do things which are more flexible and less brittle.
Absolutely. And it seems like the future proofing seems to be the way forwards with all government infrastructure.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's a couple of ways that people think about this. So one way is to say, well, I recognize the world is changing very fast, and therefore what I'm going to do is deliberately build some expiry date into the actions that I'm taking. I put a sunset clause on, I do a temporary measure, particularly in a time of crisis. Or the other thing that you do is you try to reconsider you know, what's the right structures and institutions to be the custodians of this policy or this rules or this regulation? And sometimes, you know, lots of historic examples of taking powers out of out of the executive and putting them into arm's length bodies, different approaches to moving things into regulation is more flexible than primary legislation and so on. But none of that straightforward. And I think the internet has certainly challenged a lot of our assumptions about how quickly you need to be able to respond when business models change or new innovations take hold.
Absolutely. I've been, like I imagine so many people, binge watching The West Wing during lockdown. And I was struck by a season one episode from 1999 where Sam Seaborn is arguing the case why Judge Mendoza should be on the bench. And he talks about that the next 20 to 30 years is all about the issues and the responses around the issues relating to privacy. And you've written quite a lot about the need to take privacy concerns into policy setting. So firstly, do you agree with Sam's prediction, and how is it looking so far?
Yeah, I think that was pretty prescient. I think, all of us, it feels to me like our relationship with privacy and data and what we control versus what other people and other organizations control has shifted quite dramatically. I think that, as you try to navigate this from a policy perspective, one of the things which I think is really challenging is the extent to which you think it's the state's role to be the guardian and protector, or the extent to which you think it's for individuals to take responsibility. And it's not, I think, a kind of slam dunk in either direction. We know that people are often quite capable of making decisions for themselves, and when they do, those can be better than if they've been dictated by somebody else. But we also know that people don't always read all the terms and conditions or pay attention to every aspect of what they're getting involved in. The thing that I think leaves me feeling optimistic about all of this is that as we spend more time with technology in our lives, and as we get more used to making these kinds of decisions and trade-offs, then it takes time, but we feel a way through this, and you see pressure being applied in different instances, and we've had different laws and regulations around privacy and data protection come and get stronger. We've had consumers putting pressure on some companies, or voting with their feet in terms of and their wallets, right, in terms of how their data is used. But I don't think this is solved. There is, I think, a fascinating kind of tangent on this about the extent to which new technologies will give people more control of their data and abilities to grant permission, revoke permission, share and stop sharing in ways that were just not possible before you had digital tools and the internet. But I think a lot of this, what frustrates me sometimes is that I feel like we often have the same debate about privacy that we would have had 20 years ago, when the kind of technological foundations are quite different now. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that the concerns are gone, right? But actually they can, to some extent, they can be mitigated by advances in technology. So, the fact that we've got widespread access to strong encryption is very different to how the world was when that used to be a specialist capability that if you're in the security services, you had access to, and if you were a regular person, you didn't. So there are new opportunities and new challenges, but the point is the debate needs to be had in a different way rather than just reheat the arguments of the past.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it does seem to be that because technology is moving so quickly, that it's hard for the policy that surrounds it. It does seem to have this permanent time lag, and by the time you've narrowed down exactly what needs to happen in that case, it's moved on by about 5 years.
Yeah, exactly, because you've got this amazing the cadence at which these things happen, right? So if you are in a big Silicon Valley tech company, the development team there are, pushing a new version or an updated version of the app, mm-hmm. in some instances several times a day, or if not that, then certainly, on a weekly basis. And then you've got at the other end of the spectrum, the time from, the first government consultation or, twinkle in somebody's eye that we might want to revisit the policy on something, through to piloting that all the way through the parliamentary process and then executing the policy, can be years.
Yeah.
So, new products or new companies can be conceived of, born, grow, mature, and change completely before the rules you're trying to put in place around them have made it anywhere near royal assent. So, I mean, that's a real challenge, and it's not immediately clear to me quite how you solve it. Right? Answers that help you to move faster often also involve removing this from democratic, you know, oversight and engagement, which obviously is not an acceptable answer. But then, you know, also appetite to compress parliamentary timetables is, you know, limited, and where it has been, you know, used for other things has been controversial. So, you know, I think there's a whole set of difficult, you know, considerations that are coming at us in the years ahead.
Yeah. So are you optimistic about how it's, the sort of trajectory of it? Do you feel like that you'd like to be more optimistic than you are?
I'm pretty optimistic. I think that, look, in the end, I would say a couple of things. One is that for all of the things that you know, policymakers agonize about in terms of technology and disruption and the way that it's changed the world, if we can deal with those, right, and they're difficult, but, you know, mankind or humanity has dealt with hard problems before. If we can understand these and navigate them, then you unlock, I think, tremendous upside. Right, we should be having conversations about how you use technology to, you know, transform access to opportunity, revolutionize education so that the very best schooling is available to the most disadvantaged kids, completely alter our approach to healthcare, end the climate emergency. Right, the list goes on. Technology has an important role to play in all of those things, and we'll have a much more productive conversation once we get over, you know, a lot of the near-term pressure that the disruption is causing. And then I think the other thing to say is that in the end, all of this is driven by people, right? Like, it's not like it's exogenous and it's happening to us. You know, the things which are so big in our lives now, you know, the kind of the way that our relationship with technology and the internet has changed, and you know, the way that it's altered lots of our habits in our society, it's by and large because technology delivers huge benefits that people value. And, you know, we can all have a grumble about whichever, you know, app or whatever else is bothering us. But at the end of the day, I think few people would argue they want to go back to a world before the internet, mm-hmm. before smartphones, and before access to all of the opportunity and wonder that it brings us. So I am optimistic. I think, you know, you need a set of, you know, policymakers and political leaders and, you know, leaders in the technology arena who have got, you know, the kind of foresight and the humility to engage properly with these topics. And I think it'll be bumpy, but I think we'll get to a good place.
Well, that's reassuring. So looking in terms of the process of kind of how a bill becomes a law, if you wake up at 3 a.m. and think, I know of the perfect idea, we're going to have a COVID health pass, it's going to be run by a third party, so there's no privacy problems, and it's going to be an app. This is brilliant. This should happen. How do you get from that 3 a.m. idea to it being announced in the Commons?
Good question. Look, I think the paths are many and varied, but I think there's a few like important staging posts along the way. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the policy development and design, for me, there's a couple of parts to this. One is you've got to do some proper structured analysis to understand, you know, is my 3 a.m. idea, you know, robust to different scenarios? Have I taken account of the different trade-offs involved in formulating it? What do I think about the risks and as well as the upside, and can I quantify any of this? So you get structure right. And then I think you've got to find a way of actually then explaining it to people in straightforward terms that somebody with 500 other pressures on their time and, you know, the media on their case and everything else can engage with. And as a real art to you know, compressing a complicated idea down to, you know, a single thought and the supporting arguments and the evidence underneath them, which is, you know, consistent and coherent in both directions, or up and down. So once you've got that, then obviously you need to have the conversation with, you know, the advisors, the politicians, the people who will be actually kind of executing on this. And I think there, one of the things which makes this sort of applied policy work quite different to more academic work is that you've got to be, you know, both confident in the position that you are articulating and also alive to the political reality that you're operating in, because none of this happens in a vacuum, and simply being correct is, you know, I was about to say that's sort of necessary but not sufficient, maybe not always necessary either, right? But certainly being correct doesn't guarantee that, you know, a good idea becomes policy. It has to actually land in the political moment. It has to be consistent with you know, what else the government is trying to achieve. It's got to be able to command the right coalition of support, and therefore speak to different audiences. Mm-hmm. I think that one thing that you often see going awry is that, you know, sometimes the delta between, you know, what you would say is conventional wisdom in sort of policy or Westminster circles, mm-hmm. is that the delta between that and mainstream public opinion can be quite large.
Sure.
And, you know, sometimes you have to understand that and figure out either how you're going to bridge it or how you're going to present or adapt your proposal in order to actually command sufficient support in the country. You know, so none of that is easy. I think that one of the important things, though, in all of it is this, you know, it's a process of continuous feedback and refinement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got to have enough flexibility that, you know, you see, you know, you mentioned the West Wing earlier, right? You see this quite a lot, right? You've got to understand where your red lines are and what you're prepared to flex on, mm-hmm. in order to achieve the primary goal. And yeah, and that's art as well as science.
Totally. So it seems a solid mixture of argument and timing as well to just to get it over the line.
And I think, you know, where you can, you know, be able to explain in straightforward terms how this is going to, you know, be beneficial or impactful on, you know, the people that, you know, you care about and, you know, whose situation you're trying to improve. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these things that policymakers think about can feel quite detached. And, you know, you've got to, you know, you want to understand the real impact on real people as part of this, not just as a sort of thought exercise, but the more you can actually kind of test it in different fora, I think the better.
Yes, so it's not too big an ask. It's pretty straightforward. in your career, it seems that you've really put a lot of your work and energy into the engine of politics, into the policy making. What appeals to you about that side of it, that sort of Whitehall element, as opposed to electoral politics? In other words, why the behind closed doors aspect instead of running for office yourself?
Yeah, I guess for me, I get a lot of satisfaction out of the problem solving aspects of this sort of work, right? So actually, for me, spending time on difficult policy challenges and trying to answer them in a way which feels to be, you know, robust and aligned with, you know, a kind of progressive view of the world and where we want it to go, I personally find that rewarding and satisfying to do. You might, you know, trace some of this back. You know, I trained as an economist and, you know, in a lot of analytical methods, and so I feel very comfortable in that space. I guess, you know, and then, you know, there's a big question right now about, you know, the broader political environment. You know, we were having this conversation amongst some of my friends the other day. You know, why is it so many people who care so much about the state of the world would never consider, you know, running for political office in a way which, you know, had we all been born 20 or 30 years prior, maybe might have been quite a different story. I do think, you know, when I look at, you know, MPs of all parties now, you know, regardless of their politics, I think, you know, almost everybody is there with good intentions, and I'm full of admiration for the work that they do, and frankly, for what politicians put up with in the modern environment. So, you know, I think the demands on them are very high. I think it's not something that I would rule out, but it's something that I would think very, very hard about. And, you know, I think, I mean, the other part of the answer to this question is, you know, look at the state of policymaking and the policy debate, and I feel like there's a lot of value to be added with, you know, pragmatic, actionable, but well-argued and intellectually, you know, robust policy. And I think, you know, one of the things which has been very frustrating for many of us over recent years is watching you know, a kind of avalanche of policy arriving, which often was really an avalanche of opinion, mm-hmm. with not an awful lot of structural evidence to support it, just sort of conjecture. And, you know, watching how often that backfires, you know, is pretty troubling. So I think, you know, the contribution that we're trying to make at the Institute and in the work that we do is to put some rigor and analysis back into the debate. Hmm. Because then you can, you know, I'm relatively relaxed about who goes on to implement it. The point is that it should be sound policy,
sure.
You know, properly structured and in line with, you know, the way we think the world ought to be.
Yeah, and I suppose the more time you don't have to worry about running for re-election and working about who to court in certain circles, the more time you can spend ensuring these ideas are as watertight and robust as possible.
Yeah, yeah. I do think there's the future of politics will be interesting. And one thing which I'm really fascinated by is, you know, how and when, you know, the role and the functions of politicians and political parties will catch up with the world as it is in the 2020s. Mm-hmm. You know, for all the talk of, you know, sort of modernizing different parties and, you know, reflecting the way the world now is, and huge progress has been made, right? Don't get me wrong. But still, I feel like a lot of people's notion of, you know, a modernized mainstream political party in the UK of whichever political persuasion is pretty much what we have at the moment, but with a better website and a better social media team.
Sure.
And that's not modernizing politics, right? That's just better marketing. There's, I think, a real opportunity for someone to seize around actually a different way of doing politics, a different way of engaging with voters, a different way of collaborating on problem solving, different ways of executing on some aspects of public policy. Like, one of the amazing lessons of tech is that, you know, you can do a lot more outside of the traditional institutions of power than you could in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, where's the political party that's going to build some tools that make people's lives better, even though they're not in government? Mm-hmm. You know, wouldn't that be exciting and interesting, rather than just standing up and bashing, you know, whoever's on the other benches? So, I don't know when that will happen. I really hope that it does happen.
Yeah.
If anybody listening to this, you know, is in the sort of tech and innovation space but cares deeply about the future of politics in the UK, then, you know, we should have a talk about this, because I feel like there's got to be a better way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we could get that right, maybe it would, you know, change what I mentioned earlier about the fact that so many people, you know, find politics off-putting rather than, you know, a calling.
I hope so too. So what would you say would be, looking ahead to 2031, maybe 2041, what's one thing we should be excited about? What's one thing we should be wary about?
It's quite a long horizon to see what happens on, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Look, I think it's a double-edged sword, right? So I would be on that kind of horizon. I think there's the potential for, you know, real progress on climate and green technology, mm-hmm. and finally, like, you know, ending the false starts on dealing with lots of our environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty optimistic about that, but I would also be, you know, concerned that if we don't get our act together soon, that we're going to be in pretty serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I think is really cause for optimism is, you know, you watch how the internet has altered people's access to opportunity across all different domains, right? And changed the way that we work. It's changed our access to education. You know, we're at the point where, you know, it's phenomenal that I can go on YouTube and learn from the best teachers in, you know, on the planet on any subject under the sun, right? So, you know, I'm really optimistic about how that will continue to improve people's chances, not just in the UK, actually, but around the world. And you look at, you know, many lower and middle income countries where you've got severe access and lack of access to teachers, to affordable healthcare, and so on. I do think technology has the potential to change all of that for the better, right? And actually alter the course of billions of lives. And when that happens, I think it will be, you know, really quite exciting, you know, phenomenal for the people involved, but also exciting for us as a, you know, global society to have that level of inclusion come together. So, you know, whether by 2030 we get there, I don't know. By the middle of the century, would be very hopeful. And I think the relationships that we have and the community that we're part of, mm-hmm. Will be, you know, much richer as a result.
Well, that sounds lovely. We're short on time, I realise. So very finally, why would you say that we need good storytellers in government?
I think you need good storytellers in government because actually most of what governments are trying to do, you know, requires consent from the public, and it requires actually us together, right, all of us, to have some shared sense of who we are as a community, as a nation, as a set of people, you know, on a journey together. And we won't always agree with each other, but actually, like most of politics, is about storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, most of you know, the power that you wield in government is the ability to set the narrative. I think that's under more pressure than it has been in the past because the media environment has changed. But that doesn't mean you step away. It means actually you've got to reinvent your craft. And so, you know, the more people in and around who are thinking in that way, the better chance you have of constructive debate rather than, you know, poisonous division.
Well, I hope they hear this and come into politics. All right. Chrissy, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.